Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, May 15th. The headlines and commentary were virtually the same by Monday morning. Europe had bought itself more time with a $1 trillion rescue package for Greece, its sick brethren, and the euro currency. Global markets celebrated for, about 72 hours and then fell back into free fall. Not exactly the length of time the continent was thinking of, most hoping for a year or two of stability before the next crisis or for solutions to begin to work themselves out. Alas, it's not likely to be that easy. Greece, Spain, and Portugal may be able to refinance their bonds, but the long-term issues remain the same. Massive debt at the government and individual level, and you can throw in the likes of non-Euro Britain, as well as the United States and Japan while you're at it. In a nutshell, what the European Union, European Central Bank, and International Monetary Fund, of which the United States is a rather prominent member, meaning American taxpayers have a stake in what happens in Europe, whether we like it or not, did was to put a pile of money together, about $560 billion from the 16-nation Eurozone, $320 billion from the IMF, and $80 billion from the European Commission. By midweek, some money was flowing to Greece in preparation for its having to roll over a bunch of debt on May 19. Workers there have called for a massive strike on May 20 to celebrate. But the details of how and when the money will aid those who need it, and just as importantly, who will pay what into the fund when these guys really do hate each other, has yet to be determined. Nothing I learned this week changes in any way my thesis that there is zero reason to be optimistic about literally anything these days. It doesn't help that British Petroleum is destroying the Gulf of Mexico, and not for nothing, but any rational analysis of the picture in Afghanistan and Iraq should lead to one conclusion. We're on the verge of losing both wars. We'll officially realize this last fact by year-end, around the time Iran, through its proxies, starts a region-wide conflict of its own. I repeat what I've been saying all year. This negativity doesn't mean we won't have good months or even years in the future when it comes to equities. And I have a large investment of my own in China that I still see working out by end of 2011, while I'm not rushing to buy gold like some of my friends. But the trend for planet Earth is down. But back to the here and now, as this is a week in review after all, the ECB, as part of the rescue plan, will be buying the government bonds of Greece, Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy, even as this creates a moral hazard, other nations believing that they can continue to take risk and avoid the pain since they know they, too, will just be bailed out. And former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker voiced his concern over a, quote, potential disintegration of the euro. The essential element of discipline in economic policy and in fiscal policy that was hoped for has so far not been rewarded in some countries. That was Paul Volcker. At least Greece, Portugal, and Spain, as well as the new coalition government in Britain, began to take the painful steps. Cuts to public service pay and pension plans, increases in the retirement age, higher taxes, a crisis tax in Portugal, to be exact, none of which are being well received among the populace, especially the trade unionist whose increasing protest over the course of the summer will dominate our cable television screens. More fun watching riot police batter spoiled citizenry than one of those dumb LA freeway car chases, most of you would agree. Gideon Rachman, Financial Times. Greece's financial crisis is unfortunately an extreme example of a broader European problem. Investors have been looking nervously at debt levels and budget deficits in Spain, Portugal, and Ireland for months. But even Europe's big four, Britain, France, Italy, and Germany, are hardly immune from concern. Italy's public debt is about 115% of GDP. Some 20% of this needs to be rolled over during the course of 2010. Britain is currently running a budget deficit of nearly 12% of GDP, one of the largest in Europe. George Osborne, who took over as finance minister, has described Britain's official economic forecast as a, quote, work of fiction. The French government has not produced a balanced budget for more than 30 years, and one of the reasons for the deep bitterness in Germany at bailing out Greece is the knowledge that Germany is already struggling to balance its own books. It is true that the citizens of Latvia and Ireland have already swallowed actual cuts in wages and pensions, But these are both countries that have experienced real poverty in living memory, followed by massive and unsustainable booms. They know that the last few years have been a bit unreal. Gideon Rachman continues, as the riots on the streets of Athens illustrate, however, not all Europeans will react so stoically to deep cuts in spending. Many have come to regard early retirement, free public health care, and generous unemployment benefits as fundamental rights. They stopped asking a long time ago how these things were paid for. It is this sense of entitlement that makes reform so very difficult. Yet, if Europeans do not accept austerity now, they will eventually be faced with something far more shocking: sovereign debt defaults and collapsing banks. For many Europeans, that is the kind of thing that only happens in Latin America. The discovery that Latin Europe, and maybe Northern Europe too, can also hit the financial wall will come as a horrible shock. Again, that was Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times. To me, the bottom line is the harsh austerity programs now being implemented are obviously not a recipe for growth, which also means that for a time, government revenues will shrink further and deficits increase until the likes of Greece hit bottom. And then you have this omnipresent issue of terrorism. Here I wrote what I did on the topic last week, reinforcing my main theme for 2010, an event or events that will crush sentiment. And the next day, 60 Minutes had a segment offering you zero reason for optimism on this front, including the issue of the 50,000 Somalis, many of whom are becoming radicalized, that now call Minneapolis home. Also on Sunday, appearing on ABC's This Week, academic and author Shelby Steele observed that the issue today is one of Islamist being unable to deal with modernity. What's depressing is there is no solution, except we must all continue to remember that if we see something, say something. Other topics on China, my little specialty chemical biodiesel company in Fujian province reported earnings on Friday and revenues soared thanks to ramping up production at the new facility, though the bottom line was a little light. But on the conference call, there was zero talk of any slowdown concerns, which I focus on extensively myself. It's an example of how you have to separate some of the problems faced in the major urban areas of China, i.e. the real estate boom, with those of the broader country as a whole. Despite all the doom and gloomers on China, strategists and short sellers such as Mark Faber and Jim Chanos that I've highlighted in this space, I maintain China will be successful in engineering a soft landing, even with the developing global crisis. But certainly China's equity market, down roughly 20% year-to-date, is telling you a major slowdown is on the way. Can China and Asia proper survive while others go up in smoke? I placed my bet on red, and sometimes I feel like I'm watching the ball spin endlessly around the roulette wheel, round and round and round. Come on, land on red, baby, as I await the one quarter, now moved forward to August, at least, where the market reacts positively to a strong bottom line figure. But enough about me, except to add my play has significantly outperformed the overall Chinese market thus far in 2010. China reported a number of key readings this week, such as exports for April up 30.5%, retail sales for the month up 18.5% over year-ago levels, and industrial production up 18%. But bank lending rose significantly, not exactly what the government wanted to see, while housing prices increased 12.8% in 20 major cities, and consumer prices rose 2.8%, with food leading the way up 5.9%. It's this last bit that has some spooked: rising inflation and how to prick the housing bubble. China continues to increase capital requirements on the major banks, and this is transparent, but less so is what's going on with the local governments and their own high debts. This is not transparent, and a real problem for Beijing. What the government does know is that in some of the major cities, with all the levels of restrictions being mandated on housing, transactions were down 40% in April over March, though prices haven't dropped yet. They will, and some say up to 30%. It's how the people and government handle that coming aspect that determines whether the communists do indeed engineer a soft landing. As to the U.S. real estate picture, I've been remiss in not bringing to the table my own observations. As in the past few months, I cannot believe how many homes finally have a foreclosure sale sign in the yard. You'd see the same place as last fall, looking increasingly uncared for, yards a mess, grass uncut, and knew the bank, once they could identify which one was really responsible, would eventually bite the bullet. And my New York metro area is about the last in the nation to face reality, in keeping with the fact that Wall Street had a huge positive impact on housing here until the crash of 2008, unemployment, and reduced bonuses. So I got a kick out of some of the national data on foreclosures this week. If you weren't careful in reading the headlines, or all you did was read them, you'd have thought housing was recovering, perhaps, if you only looked at the rate of foreclosures dropping 2% in April from the pace a year ago. But that hides the truth, which is that home foreclosures hit a record in April, not down 2%, because the banks are finally taking the properties onto their books, though the official data can be skewed as they are being careful how many of the homes they put on the market at one time. With an official unemployment rate of 9.9% and a more realistic one of 17%, there is zero cause for optimism, as if after my opening you thought I was going to give you any. As my West Coast housing expert Josh P. and I were comparing notes on the topic, I don't even think about a real recovery in prices. JP thinks we still have another leg down. I'm sticking with my November 08 forecast that once we bottomed, which I said was April 09, we'd just sit there. And wouldn't you know, 1 year later, the National Association of Realtors said this week that the median first quarter 2010 home price was exactly the same as a year earlier. The bottom line on housing, especially with the expiration of the first-time home buyer credits, a putrid labor market, and a continuing crisis in confidence, of which last Sunday's 60 Minutes piece on walking away didn't help, there will be no major housing recovery. Incidentally, my new office faces three new homes that are being built, the same developer who put up the condo building I'm now in. I imagine he would beg to differ with me. I'll let you know what they sell for compared to what he would have received in 2007. And if you've talked about housing, you really have to bring up the issue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which mysteriously have no real part in financial reform regulation winding its way through Congress. Alabama Republican Senator Richard Shelby said of the legislation being crafted that it, quote, touches nearly every corner of the economy, but these major contributors to the crisis are left unscathed. For years, Democrats blocked meaningful reform of Fannie and Freddie, and not much has changed. Gretchen Morgenson, New York Times. If you blinked, you might have missed the ugly first quarter report last week from Freddie Mac, the mortgage finance giant that, along with its sister Fannie Mae, soldiers on as one of the financial world's biggest wards of the state. Freddie, already propped up with $52 billion in taxpayer funds used to rescue the company from its own mistakes, recorded a loss of $6.7 billion and said it would require an additional $10.6 billion from taxpayers to shore up its financial position. The news caused nary a ripple in the placid Washington scene. Perhaps that's because many lawmakers, especially those who once assured us that Fannie and Freddie would never cost taxpayers a dime, hope that their constituents don't notice the burgeoning money pit these mortgage monsters represent. Some $130 billion in federal money had already been larded on both companies before Freddie's latest request. Ms. Morgenson goes on to paint an even worse picture, such as a big pickup in serious delinquencies on Freddie's portfolio, for one. Quote, the company's inventory of foreclosed properties rose from 29,145 units at the end of March 2009 to almost 54,000 units this year. But I thought one of the headlines this week said foreclosures were down. Ever wonder why your editor attempts to read everything? There's your answer. Meanwhile, Fannie asked us taxpayers for an additional $8.4 billion in aid this week. Editorial Wall Street Journal. Fannie Mae is the Cal Ripken of bad real estate deals, reliable pouring taxpayer money into the housing market. Granted, Fannie faces tough competition from its toxic twin, Freddie Mac. Once the checks from Treasury clear, Fan and Fred will have consumed a combined $145 billion in taxpayer cash, and the end is nowhere in sight. The losses are unlimited because the companies are now run by the government not to make money by deliberately subsidizing housing. The real joke is that the Obama administration and Senator Chris Dodd have collaborated on a financial regulatory reform bill that includes no reform of Fan or Fred. Meanwhile, stocks did rally back after the previous 2 weeks' swoon. though following Monday's rocket shot after the European Union and the IMF agreed on a bailout package, without any specifics, the Dow Jones and S&P 500 ended the week lower than Monday's close. Overall, however, the Dow rose 2.3% to 10,620. The S&P added 2.2% and NASDAQ added 3.6%. The economic news was once again solid, with April retail sales up a better-than-expected 0.4% and industrial production climbing a solid 0.8% for the month. But there was caution on the earnings front, including from John Chambers and Cisco Systems. Chambers, who was so ebullient 3 months earlier, was a little less so this time around in discussing the rest of 2010 because he, like everyone else, can't get his arms around the impact of Europe's problems on the rest of the globe, let alone how a soaring greenback could hurt the bottom line of the big multinationals whose exports are now more expensive. But I also found it interesting that in the case of Macy's, Kohl's, and Nordstrom's, all were pleased with first quarter results, but at the same time offered that it was unclear just how the consumer would act the second half of the year, which has been my point all along, though I feel like I know how it will act precisely. It will rein in spending anew. Kohl's said its customers are telling us they expect to spend less. Another giant, Japan's Sony, also issued caution in discussing its global outlook. Just a few weeks ago, the likes of Caterpillar, DuPont, and Dow Chemical were touting a rebound in the manufacturing sector, but the world has changed drastically since then. As to the issue of what caused the market crash on Thursday, May 6th, the SEC still doesn't know, except it seems clear it wasn't a fat finger data entry error, as first thought that afternoon. And yet another example of wait 24 hours, you morons. If you were a trader with fat fingers that day, forget being given your Miranda rights. You were turned over to Jack Bauer, and, well, I don't even want to get into the details of what happened next. What does seem clear is those DAFI high-frequency trading systems, which by some estimates account for 70% of volume these days, played a large role, and now, belatedly, the SEC is proposing to act in establishing new circuit breakers. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday, May 22nd. Have a good one, and for more details, check out my Week in Review column at stocksandnews.com. Take care.